WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. You can find us on the web at WSLR.org. The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. This is the Progressive Page Turner. I'm Marianne Barasonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them. Under Donald Trump's regime, Immigration Enforcement has become the most militarized federal agency after the Pentagon. Using divisive rhetoric about violent street gangs and blatant racism, Trump convinced enough voters that a border emergency needed immediate attention. But instead of going after criminals, masked ICE agents are violently kidnapping people off the streets and terrorizing immigrant communities. People are fighting back. Sonali Kolhatkar's new book, Breaking ICE, is a collection of interviews with organizers on the front lines. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Why aren't police stopping ICE from snatching and disappearing people? I watched the videos and it's horrifying because it could be anybody. There's no identifying these people.
So this is a question that came up so much in the discussions around people who were seeing what ICE was doing, who were maybe relatively new-ish to the way in which police operate. And for those of us who have been observing police for a very long time, it made perfect sense that the police was not stopping ICE because ICE are police. And I think that is so important for us to understand because it not only helps us make better sense of what ICE is doing, it also helps us relate what it's doing to the broader state apparatus around enforcement. Essentially, we saw in city after city around the country, when police were not actively enabling ICE, they were actually working directly with them. So there are many cities around the country, like Los Angeles, where I am based, where the local police department has signed an agreement to not directly do any handoffs with ICE, to not work directly with ICE, but they still do it. The way it works out is that ICE agents will show up, and if activists show up to a place or launch a protest, the police will kettle the protesters. They will arrest people. They will help ICE do their job by keeping protesters away from them. In other cities, it's a lot more direct. Police will simply arrest folks. And if they suspect you of being an immigrant, they will hand you over to ICE. So ICE agents, Border Patrol agents, federal agents that are doing any kind of immigration enforcement are police. And even those people who showed up masked with no identifying information, who could have been literally anybody off of the street wearing a store-bought flak jacket and claiming to be official, these were people that did what they wanted to do without being hampered in any way because they are police. They are just police by a different name. And I think the sooner that we all as Americans understand that, the better.
I think it's been a shock to a lot of white Americans that the police are aiding this obviously unconstitutional militant force. But people of color have been dealing with this sort of policing for a long time, haven't they?
Exactly. They absolutely have. Very often, it doesn't matter what's legal and what's not legal, right? There have been countless cases where Police have engaged in unconstitutional stops. Police have fired first and asked questions later. Police have violated people's constitutional rights right from the start over and over again. And they're often given, protected by what's called qualified immunity, protected by sympathetic prosecutors, and in general, enjoy the sympathy of the public, enjoy the sympathy of officials, and have been able to get away with violating people's constitutional rights right from the start. In cities where police have tried to codify unconstitutional behavior, like stop and frisk in New York, they have often withstood legal challenges for a long time until we've had cultural change and a handful of people in the right places to undo those. What's really interesting is right now, as you and I are talking, there's a move by ICE agents, by the ICE Department and Homeland Security to protect ICE agents and Border Patrol agents with the same qualified immunity, so-called qualified immunity that police enjoy. They want to be extended those same protections so that they can essentially get away with harming people and face no repercussions. Yet another data point to support the claim that ICE and CBP are.
So one of the cities that was targeted by ICE was Chicago. And Chicago has a long history of police abuse and corruption. Do you think that's why they chose Chicago as a test site?
Sure, that necessarily was the reason. I think that the Trump administration went after cities that have very large, diverse populations, immigrant-rich cities, cities that have Democratic mayors, and they've said it out loud in the early part of the Trump administration, the second Trump administration. You had official figures, government figures who said that we're going to go after cities with Democratic mayors because those cities are being run roughshod by criminals. They used ICE, have been using ICE and CBP as sledgehammers against their political opponents, which ought to be illegal. But, you know, under Trump administration, nothing really matters anymore. The law and order crowd actually are the lawless ones. They went after cities with Black mayors. They went after cities with communities where immigrants are so deeply enmeshed that people have, in order to sort of sow chaos. So Los Angeles was actually one of the first cities that the Trump administration went after. Early June 2025 was the start of the raids in Los Angeles, then Chicago, Minneapolis, New York City. So they've, in my opinion, and from what I can tell, have gone after cities that have had liberal mayors, that have had Democratic mayors, that have had mayors of color, and where immigrants are a large part of the culture and population. To me, there's a little side note there that I want to just bring up. I didn't bring it up in my book, but the fact that a lot of these cities with liberal mayors also have corrupt police departments, to me, is an indictment of Democratic mayors who have spoken about equality and justice and constitutional rights out of one side of their mouth and have been part of the problem out of the other side of their mouth, have increased police budgets, have not prosecuted police who have violated people's rights, and who are essentially neoliberal leaders who believe that police are a necessary part of preserving racial capitalism. I don't want to let the leaders, these liberal leaders, off the hook when it comes to police, but they have been a large part of why Trump has targeted cities like Chicago, like LA, like Minneapolis.
In the foreword of your book, Robert Lovato writes, "Murderous, violent actions by ICE are less an anomaly produced by MAGA than the product of a deadly bipartisan continuum." And that's what you're talking about, isn't it? Do you see the Democratic Party as being complicit in the ICE abuses?
I do. The issue of policing is something that I have indicted the Democrats, but absolutely immigration as well. More so with federal administrations than with local city officials. You've seen the Biden administration essentially continue far too many of Trump 1, the first Trump term's anti-immigrant agenda. He reversed a few of them, like the green card ban. Continued others, like forcing asylum seekers to have to wait outside the country while they're adjudicating their cases, and then used very strong anti-immigrant rhetoric around border security and tough on the border. You can go back to even Obama, who earned the moniker Deporter-in-Chief for rounding up and deporting millions of people. To his credit, he did also enact DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. So Democrats have not been allies to immigrants. They've been a mixed bag on immigrants, which has then left the door open for Republicans to come and say, you know, which is what Trump's second campaign did, making these wild claims about Biden rolling out the welcome mat for immigrants, throwing open the borders. Biden did not do that. And Democrats might as well have been true allies to immigrants if they were going to be cast as these pro-immigrant people anyway. But unfortunately, they haven't been. And so I think that's really, really important to point out. Local leaders haven't been as harshly anti-immigrant as they've been pro-police. And that's in a large part because immigrants have actually been very good around lobbying state government, city governments. Immigrants aren't cleanly immigrants. They exist in mixed status families. So you can have a family of 8 people, 3 of whom are citizens, 2 of whom are green card holders, and the rest might be undocumented. And those who are involved in government, have lobbied the government, have become activists, and have ensured that city governments have actually been more responsive to immigrants than, for example, federal officials have been, who are Democrats.
So it's been on the local level that the immigrants have been protected. In the interview with Ron Goches, he says that after spending hundreds of millions of dollars and sending thousands of agents, the National Guard and the U.S. Marines to Los Angeles, ICE wasn't able to disappear even 1% of the undocumented population as of July 2025. How did L.A. do that?
So this was really remarkable. And Ron is one of my favorite activists because he's somebody whose name I've come across for years. I've been a journalist in L.A. for 25 years. And this is one of the reasons why I was able to write this book is because I know the people who have done the work. I followed their work. And Ron is one of them. Pablo Alvarado of Endolon is another one. And one of the things that Ron did along with his fellow activists in LA was they laid the groundwork. They knew what was coming. They did not have any illusions about what Trump was promising to do. And in February of last year, actually even earlier than that, they started laying the groundwork for what they call community self-defense patrols. And they organized neighborhood by neighborhood to go out and come up with the scenarios of what would be required, of what would be expected of them, of what they can expect from ICE agents. And they realized that they needed to, because LA is very spread out, they had to organize neighborhood by neighborhood. And so they got together these playbooks for how to respond when ICE agents show up, how to identify ICE official cars, how to respond to them, how to install dashboard cameras, how to use megaphones to call them out. And they had this method of confronting ICE officials that worked. They would see when they would show up early in the morning, stage their operations at the parking lots of these large box stores like Walmart or Home Depot, and then community patrols would follow them. They would document what they were doing, and they would use their megaphones to warn local neighborhoods and neighbors, if you are undocumented, stay inside, do not come out. If you have citizenship, if you aren't worried about your status, come out and join us and help us observe these people. And they ran them out neighborhood by neighborhood. And essentially, the federal government realized that it just didn't work. It didn't work in LA. Now, that's not to say that it didn't have an impact. Hundreds of people were rounded up and disappeared, thousands of people actually, but it was still a very tiny fraction of LA's undocumented population. And we saw this playbook play out in city after city very successfully. And the remarkable part of this story that I want to point out is that opposition to the anti-immigrant agenda has been much more successful than we realize. People haven't rolled over. People have confronted them. Right before you called me, I was working on a story about how detention centers are shutting down. Remember Alligator Alcatraz in Florida? A year after it opened, it has officially shut down. Delaney Hall in Newark, New Jersey is in the process of being under such public scrutiny, it is likely to shut down. And ICE, after purchasing 7 giant warehouses, has decided to sell them because the new head of DHS has realized that it's more useful to do these kinds of raids more quietly than the very open way in which Kristi Noem was doing them, where she garnered a lot of opposition. So people's resistance worked. The resistance of people like Ron Gochas has been working.
The Sarasota County Supervisor of Elections is seeking poll workers for the August 18th primary election. Poll workers are needed throughout Sarasota County to support local voting precincts during the upcoming election. Training is provided, and poll workers are compensated for their time. To qualify, individuals must be registered voters in Sarasota County and able to read, write, and speak English. More information is available at sarasotavotes.gov or by calling 941-861-8640. You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest is Sonali Kolhatkar, and we're talking about her book, Breaking Ice. How has the ICE raids affected rural America?
Good question. So the broader context of that is that rural America has been much more immigrant heavy in recent years than those of us who live in urban America realize. Immigrants are everywhere in the United States. So I talked to organizers in Maine and North Carolina and Wisconsin and Georgia, in parts of the country where immigrants have revitalized communities in farming lands, in service industries, and they have been very much a part of the community. I interviewed Nikki Marin Baina of Siembra NC. NC stands for North Carolina, and her organization's main work before the ICE raids was to help undocumented immigrants recover stolen wages because they were being taken advantage of and exploited. And then, of course, Siembra NC pivoted to opposing the ICE raids and organizing immigrants, but they've been impacted pretty severely. It wasn't just urban cities with big immigrant populations and liberal mayors that were impacted. You saw people in Maine, the whitest state in the nation, whose immigrants are largely from sub-Saharan Africa, be impacted horribly. You saw people from Springfield, Ohio, where there's a huge Haitian population that has revitalized that community, being impacted horribly. You saw auto workers in Georgia who are from Korea and Central America being rounded up in a raid. And by the way, many of these people, a significant portion of them, possibly half or more, are not undocumented. They are here with papers. They have work authorizations, and the Trump administration doesn't care. So these questions around legality and illegality are irrelevant as a side note. But yes, people in rural America were deeply impacted and also rose up, and they learned from the playbooks of folks in urban America.
Well, the Supreme Court just handed Trump a big victory by getting rid of the temporary protected status of that's going to impact a lot of immigrants. But I think most Americans don't understand that a lot of the problems that we've seen in places like Central America are actually due to U.S. intervention. And there's one of the interviews in the book, you go over the history of that. How did U.S. intervention in Central America lead to the violent gangs in El Salvador and other countries?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you picked up on this issue. I think it's really important because remember the U.S. government tried to make an example of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, this hardworking immigrant from El Salvador who was sent to seek out the notorious gulag in El Salvador. Not only is Roberto Lovato, who wrote the foreword to the book, Salvadoran American, but I also interviewed Luis Rodriguez, who has been to El Salvador, who is a former gang member turned journalist, who's wrote the best-selling book, Always Running. He's been to El Salvador and studied what's happened there. And I also talked to Pulitzer Prize-winning author Viet Thanh Nguyen, who visited El Salvador and who, as a Vietnamese refugee, was able to apply his story to what he saw in El Salvador. And basically, this is a country that experienced internal turmoil, a civil war, and the refugees that fled El Salvador as a result of U.S. involvement, by the way, came to cities like Los Angeles. And in Los Angeles, they were disaffected youth who did not have opportunities, who were traumatized, many of them from their home countries, and who formed gangs, some of whom were violent. And when those gangs were deported back to El Salvador, they spread some of that activity there in El Salvador, which then led El Salvador's government to elect right-wing governments to crack down on some of these gang members and people suspected of being gang members. The history is very much intertwined. It's a sordid history, and it's been used to then demonize and criminalize any and all Central Americans, and particularly Salvadorans. The good news is that while the Trump administration was trying to paint Kilmer Abrego Garcia as this violent criminal, going as far as making up that he had gang tattoos of MS-13, Mara Salvatrucha 13 on his knuckles, that story didn't actually get as much traction as the other story of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, which is that he was is a hardworking father of multiple children who are special needs and who has been a important member of his local community. That's the story that more Americans found that they could relate to than the far-fetched story by the Trump administration about him. But yes, it's so important for us to remember and to remind ourselves that our foreign policy in many, many ways has made the world less stable, made it less safe, and has fed the forces causing a lot of people to flee for their safety to countries like the U.S. and elsewhere.
You were talking about the role of the stories around Kilmer Abrego Garcia. What's the role of storytelling in combating propaganda against immigrants?
It's such an important question, and I'm always seeking to think about these stories and trying to study them. My 2023 book, Rising Up, was about narrative. The subtitle is The Power of Narrative in Pursuing Racial Justice. And there are competing stories around immigrants, right? The Trump administration's story is that they're all criminals by virtue of existing. Literally, by being in the country and not being a citizen, they are criminal and therefore must be deported. They're not one of us. It's grounded in racial animus and racism. It's grounded in white supremacy. It's grounded in this idea, you know, us versus them. The others are stealing your job, stealing your culture, replacing you. That's their story. The real story is that America is generally a land of immigrants. That's a very reductive way of putting it. But in general, it's been largely built by immigrants, by stolen labor as well, from the Black community on stolen lands, lands of the indigenous population of Turtle Island. The story of immigrants is being the ones who have enriched our culture, being the ones who we need more than they need us, is the story that I think most Americans, if they were to really interrogate their own communities, would conclude. You know, think about healthcare workers, physicians, nurses, technicians, home healthcare workers, nursing home workers, dominated by immigrants, that our economy relies on as we have an aging population. And now we're creating a situation where we have such a shortage of these workers. Think about agriculture and farming and our food industry that's so deeply dependent on these workers, construction industries. And by the way, a new study that came out recently pointed out that some of these jobs that were lost, that people stopped being able to come to because they were deported or too scared to show up for, the employers didn't turn around, raise the wages, and try to employ U.S.-born citizens. They just shut down operations and moved away. Losing immigrants is ruining our economy. That's another story that I hope will also stick. But also this idea that this myth around the American meritocracy, if you want to know where it works best, look at immigrant communities who work so hard, who are so grateful to be here, and who have enriched our community through their culture, their cuisine, their music, their art, and their ability to strengthen ties. It is so, so important for us to keep hammering that story, because it is a story that can apply actually to most of us in this country who don't have Black ancestry or Indigenous ancestry. The rest of us are immigrants.
One of the pieces of ideology that's been fueling the anti-immigrant sentiment has been the great replacement theory. What is that, and why do you think it's captured people's imaginations?
So Tucker Carlson is one of the earliest purveyors of the great replacement theory. It's so interesting because, of course, he's been in the news lately for disavowing a lot of his agenda that he helped to promote. And one of the interviews that I did in the book that I'm so excited that I was able to include, it was sort of a last minute addition, is Ibram X. Kendi. And it was last minute because I had just done an interview with him right after I'd submitted all the other interviews for the book. His own book, The Great Replacement, came out. I interviewed him and I was like, I have to include this. My editor urged me to include it into the book. He writes about how this idea that very much has roots in Nazi ideology is at the heart of so much anti-immigrant sentiment. And by the way, I want to also just correct one thing that I said earlier about Black ancestry. A huge portion of Black immigrants are a thing, obviously, and they're disproportionately impacted. So I didn't mean to suggest that if you're Black, you don't have immigrant ancestry, because many Black people in this country do, from the Caribbean, from countries like Somalia and Haiti. But Ibram X. Kendi, by the way, who wrote about the Great Replacement Theory and who's in this book, points out how incredibly important it is for us to identify that the scapegoating of immigrants is an age-old trope, an age-old racist trope that has a direct line from rhetoric into genocide. The rhetoric against Jews, the rhetoric against people in countries where we've seen genocides play out, like Myanmar against the Rohingya. Rhetoric starts out one way, and if it keeps getting acted on, the end result can be genocide if we don't stop it. And this is so important because we have seen the Trump administration officials echo this rhetoric, talking about immigrants poisoning the blood of the nation. The right-wing hate groups that marched through Charlottesville chanting "Jews will not replace us" were exactly saying the same words. This is ideology that has its roots in the United States, that has it in racist Europe. And the right-wing racist ideologues who promote this theory are all working together. They are united. This is something that Ibram X. Kendi points out. They are coordinated and working together, and their agenda is one and the same, which is to essentially fuel racism against communities of color, to keep us as an underclass, to scapegoat us, so that when people complain about being victims of capitalism, they blame immigrants rather than billionaires. It's really, really important for us to identify that.
So many people believe that electing a Democratic majority this November will put a stop to the worst of the ICE abuses. Do you believe that?
If Democrats get the House and the Senate, a majority in the House and the Senate, it is very likely that they will not sign off on the Trump administration's anti-immigrant or anti-anything legislative agenda, on any parts of Trump's legislative agenda. It's very likely. However, as we've just seen and as you raised earlier, Trump doesn't really need Democrats to sign off on his agenda if they win the midterms, because he has the Supreme Court. He has six conservatives on the Supreme Court who have, one after the other, one decision after the other, been signing off and greenlighting his racist anti-immigrant agenda. The two rulings that just came out in mid-June, on the same day, were basically on temporary protected status and on asylum seekers. So unfortunately, I don't think the Democrats will necessarily, by gaining power, stop what he's able to do. At the same time, I do think it's really important that Republicans don't take the House and the Senate, because they will sign off, they will greenlight even more of the things that Trump wants to do, right? Trump's main legislative achievement thus far has been the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill in 2025, which has so many aspects to it, including fueling the anti-immigrant agenda. He basically got legislatively most of what he wanted. Most likely what he's going to try to do in the future is going to be things around keeping taxes on the very wealthy as low as possible permanently. So, I don't think on the case of immigration, the Democrats taking the House and the Senate necessarily will matter. That said, Democrats need to see the writing on the wall, and they have to actually live up to their platform. And we see this internal battle that's playing out within the Democratic Party right now, which I'm all here for. It's about time.
You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest has been Sonali Kolhatkar, and we've been talking about her book, Breaking Ice. Thank you. It's been a really good conversation.